Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Alva.
And I'm Stephen.
And on today's New Statesman podcast, we talk to Ben Vandermeer from the New Statesman data journalism team about a new project that looks into how many years of lives have been lost to COVID-19. Alva reports from Hartlepool, where there'll be a by-election next week. And you ask us, who's in the running to replace Arlene Foster? We're delighted to be joined on today's New Statesman podcast by Ben Vandermeer, a data journalist for the New Statesman, who's been working on an interesting project for weeks now, which is just about to be published. It's about the years lost to COVID. And you've done some exclusive analysis of COVID-19 deaths in England and Wales, is that right? Which you've used to work out how many years each victim has lost of their lives to the disease.
Yeah, so we took into account the sort of age and the gender of everyone who died in England and Wales, as well as the likelihood that they had comorbidities. And we found that on average, people lost almost a decade of life from COVID-19, and with a total years lost of around 1.35 million, which is, you know, a huge sum of years lost. It's not really a comparison with the flu, as people like to say sometimes, which is around 250,000 years lost each year.
What really struck me when you came to me with this research, when you and your colleague Josh Raymond, who has done some excellent animated graphics on this piece, which I encourage all of our listeners to go and look at, is yes, what you were saying about how what you found, that each person has lost a decade of their life, kind of undermines that message that you sometimes get from people who are more skeptical about lockdowns and things, who say, well, you know, most of these people would have died soon anyway, or sort of in a way devaluing the lives of the elderly or those with underlying health conditions.
Yeah, I mean, the majority of people lost more than half a decade of their life. And obviously, the average was close to a decade itself. So really, that's just really not compatible with the idea that these people were going to die anyway. I mean, during the start of the pandemic or over June, we had people saying, I think in the Telegraph, that the overall death toll might be half of what scientists were saying because these people would have died anyway. What we found was just, I think only around less than 6% of victims would have died within the same year anyway. So it's just completely incomparable to what people were saying before.
And the Prime Minister obviously has been in the headlines this week and being accused of saying that he'd rather let the bodies pile high than put England into a third lockdown. Could you tell us a bit about what the actual reality is like for victims of COVID-19 dying in hospital and for their families? Because, you know, this has affected so many people and it is a horrible process, isn't it? And you've spoken not only to bereaved family members, but also to a palliative care doctor who is working on COVID wards, who told you a bit about what these kind of deaths are like.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he called them bodies was itself quite telling. You know, these were real people. These were people, often people who had, you know, a lot to look forward to. One of the people that we spoke to was Geeta Kausi. She was only 45 when she died this January, and is one of those people that died during England's third national lockdown. She was about to adopt her first child. She had just, with her husband, redecorated their house for the child and built a nursery. You know, these were people with lives to live. But also, I think speaking to families of those who are lost and speaking to Dr. Clark, something which the data can't really show and which we tried to show through the case studies, is that not only is the argument that these people were going to die anyway, not only is that factually wrong, but it's just so morally wrong, because, you know, for the families that they left behind, really, they would have taken any time with these people, any time at all. And there's something also about dying with COVID, which is so much more difficult than dying in other ways. I mean, the fact that these people, that they weren't able to see their family in their last days or weeks as they lay in hospital, it really had a huge effect on their quality of death and sort of how their family was able to say goodbye to them.
We should say that the Prime Minister has denied using those words, although a number of sources have said that he did. Stephen or Alva, do you want to ask Ben any questions about his research? I know you've yet to be able to see the piece yet because it's not out at the time that we're recording.
When you sort of embarked on this, is this roughly what you were expecting, or were there any particular surprises to you in the data?
I was surprised that the average years of life lost was so high, because we have this image of the victims as being overwhelmingly the elderly and those with sort of multiple comorbidities, was in reality, you know, that was a large proportion of the victims, but there was also a large number of people who, you know, would have lived for many decades longer without COVID. And again, it's not to say that those lives were any more valuable, but it's just to show that the sort of the popular conception of what has happened over the past year is just wrong on a lot of counts. Yeah. One of the things that was quite striking also was the sort of the gender difference. I think whether you look at the median or the mean sort of number of years lost, for each man, they lost an extra year of their life compared to women, which is a separate issue from the number who died. We weren't able to look at ethnicity, which I think would have been much more striking. The data just wasn't there. But if you consider the fact that it was 9% of deaths among white men were under 64, but for black men, the figure was 23%. So the years of life lost for ethnic minorities and black people in particular in this country would have been far, far higher than for their white counterparts.
I suppose my question would be, Ben, and feel free to say that you just don't know, but I'm wondering if from this data, there are any lessons that we can draw from what the unlocking and the vaccination program means or doesn't mean, in that the argument is that since the vast majority of people who'd be considered vulnerable, so older people and people with underlying health conditions, if they've already been vaccinated, then unlocking and allowing, I suppose, the virus to spread more quickly shouldn't have too bad an impact on serious illness or death. But I'm wondering, from what's your impression in terms of, are you looking at people that you considered who would have been considered healthy in their 30s, for example, dying before their time in this data? Or would you be kind of confident that the vaccination program and the unlocking is continuing at the right pace?
So the data doesn't shed any sort of new light on the proportion of people who are young and healthy dying. But certainly, I think one thing that the piece does bring out is the fact that, you know, there are only sort of around 20 deaths occurring each day now. And it seems like a very small number in comparison to what we had before. But it's still, you know, it's still 20 deaths. And for, you know, then these, it's many more years of life lost. So it's definitely important not to sort of write off the pandemic as solved just yet.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ben. And the research is fascinating. And I encourage all our listeners to read the piece when it comes out, which will be on Friday morning this week. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
So in case any of our listeners had picked up on the fact that Alva doesn't sound as crystal clear as usual, it's because she is out and about in Hartlepool, where there'll be a by-election next week. Alva, what are you picking up and what have you been doing there?
Yeah, so I'm broadcasting live from the Hartlepool Marina in a pub garden. There's no one else here and it has just stopped raining. I think the main thing to say is that definitely there's going to be a low turnout in this election. That I think people don't seem super motivated or interested either way. And frankly, neither candidate from either main party is particularly impressing on the doorstep. So the Labour candidate, Paul Williams, who we've talked about before on this podcast, is a new candidate for Labour. The last Labour MP had to step down, which triggered this by-election. He's not really impressing. The thing that people, more than anything else, are saying is that they just don't understand why someone who lost his seat in Stockton is standing here. You know, if he's not good enough for them, why is he good enough for us? That's the sort of the recurring message. And I think there's a real, you know, there are very like visible problems in Hartlepool. Like a lot of businesses have really suffered with the pandemic. The local magistrate's court was closed by the Conservative government a few years ago, which is like very much front and center in people's minds. And then there's the ongoing issue of the lack of hospital in Hartlepool and on various hospital changes. So I think that there's a sort of feeling of dissatisfaction with Labour that's coming across very strongly, really. But then also, I don't think people are very impressed by Jill Mortimer, the Conservative candidate. She hasn't been very visible. People here will tell you that she's not local. Although clearly someone in CCHQ thought that she was local enough to stand. And so it's a sort of, it's an interesting one. The other thing to say is that there are loads of independents standing and lots of smaller parties. So you've got the SDP, the North East Party. You have the ex-husband of David Cameron's former deputy chief of staff. You have the Northern Independence Party. So it's a kind of vibrant election. And the thing about Hartlepool is that for people who are interested in this kind of thing, they'll probably know already that Hartlepool elected a monkey as mayor, or, you know, elected someone standing as the monkey mascot of the local team as mayor, and then re-elected him twice. So there's a kind of independent spirit in Hartlepool among the electorate, which is definitely coming across. People are really interested by all of the independent candidates. I don't think that there's any real expectation that they can win, but it just means that it's not really clear whether this complete apathy towards Labour and the Conservatives will result in Labour holding this, or the Conservatives gaining it.
Okay, what did you make of him? How was he on the doorstep?
So I was with him for a kind of sort of managed visit. This is a very, very trademark coronavirus pandemic. I don't think we'll be seeing any sort of campaigning like this in a few years' time. But literally, David Lammy came up from London to campaign with him, and they stood on a street corner for their big visit. And they were outside a building that had been a cannabis farm and that was shut down. And they visited with some local council candidates, and then just some local people involved in community work were telling them about efforts around crime and so on. I think everyone would tell you that Paul Williams is quite smooth. And so it's the question is whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think the thing that really was clear is that both David Lammy and Paul Williams are correctly diagnosing the problems in Hartlepool. For example, that magistrate's court, which people have mentioned quite a lot. But I think that the thing that they would say not to Paul Williams's face is that they don't necessarily trust Labour to fix it, and that their feeling of apathy extends to Labour too, and with Labour councillors and a Labour candidate. So this isn't a comment on Paul Williams in particular, but it's really hard to sort of see him connecting with people when he's standing so far away. And he has a sort of machine behind him, and he has a mask on. So I think that, you know, he says the right things, but I think it would be difficult to really inspire people with a campaign in a context like this.
What I think is interesting, so I haven't been to Hartlepool in this election, because having gone to it in a previous one, I mean, it really is far away from everywhere, right? It's far away from everywhere else in the conurbation. It's far away from London. It is just really poorly served by public transport. And it's just, and I suspect that's one of the reasons why it has such an interesting history of electing independents. But the thing I found weird when I've been out and about in this election is how unlike an election it feels. Alva, having been, you know, out and about during the 2019 election, does this place, then, you know, the might of the two parties has come down on, does it feel election-y there?
No, I mean, I think that the only thing that feels election-y is that in the Premier Inn where I'm staying, there are definitely lots of other London journalists and the odd activists or person involved with either Labour or the Conservatives. In terms of, like, the mood on the doorstep, it's really you couldn't overstate how much things are still closed here. Yeah, there aren't really that many places to sit outside and eat. So where there are, there's a bit of a buzz. But in quite a lot of the main centres, you don't get any sort of sense of it. I think if you speak to people, they still are very, very much aware that there's a by-election and that they have so many candidates to choose from and that they also have to elect a mayor and a police and crime commissioner and so on. But I don't think it compares at all to the 2019 general election, which is my only proper point of comparison, having done visits in a similar way for that one. It's a strange one because I feel like this must be the place in the country that's getting the most attention out of anywhere. For comparison, when I was in Northeast Fife in 2019, at that point, that was the most marginal seat in the UK because the SNP candidate had won it by only 2 votes in the previous election. So you literally St Andrews is not super easy to get to, even though it's lovely when you get there. Like, it was chock-a-block with journalists. I bumped into Hugo Rifkin from The Times. CNN were there. It was attracting international press interest. And yet this is the sort of the headline by-election. And even though I think there has been quite a big degree of media interest, it's only there if you look for it and you try to seek out the campaigns. Otherwise, it doesn't really feel very election-y.
That's so interesting. I remember when I went to Hartlepool for the last election, and it was a seat of interest because of the Brexit factor, because of by how much the seat voted Brexit, and because it was the Brexit Party's sort of key target at the time. And there was so much press coming to the town, and I picked up, I don't know whether you've had any of this speaking to people, Ava, but I picked up a lot of sort of like exasperation about the fact that it was such a common spot on the political safari, if you like, from people, because they had that that Channel 4 documentary. I can't remember the name of it, but it was about universal credit there. I think it was called Skint Britain. It was something that's quite controversial in the town because it didn't paint the town in a particularly good light, kind of looking at how universal credit, because it was one of the pilot towns for universal credit, had sort of taken money away from the people who needed it most, but it sort of presented it in quite a benefit streety kind of way, as some of those programs sometimes do. And I remember there was just a little bit of a feeling that people were just fed up with constantly being sort of defined by this national media spotlight. So it's interesting now. I remember interviewing Mike Hill, who was the Labour MP for Hartlepool, and he was sort of complaining about how many different media organisations had already been up, and from sort of even from abroad as well, from like around the world, they had come to kind of view it as the epicentre of Brexit Britain and things. So it's interesting that what you say is that it doesn't feel so much like that now. And I wonder if that's because of the fact that this is, I think we've spoken about these elections before in the sense that will they be the real sort of like post-Brexit elections where Brexit is no longer the priority voting issue? You know, if it ever was, you know, it didn't seem to turn out to be last time. If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
You Ask Us.
So it's kind of, yeah, the same question from multiple people. So we have, who will win the DUP leadership contest, from Zoe Birtwistle? And could you give us a run through of the likely runners and riders in the DUP leadership election? And whoever it is it likely to make much difference, from Mark Knight? So I thought we would smoosh those all into one composite question. So for those of you who have missed it, North Ireland's First Minister and the leader of the DUP, Arlene Foster, has announced she'll step down, basically in the wake of a very well organised and therefore quite dignified, but ultimately a coup from within her party. And there now may or may not be a leadership election. Usually the party has elected its leaders by acclamation. Alva, take us through the sort of most likely candidates to emerge from this process.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, a seagull has just tried to interrupt me. What is quite likely, and that's worth saying first, is that it's quite possible that the roles of First Minister of Northern Ireland, who has to be obviously based in Stormont, will be separated from the leader of the DUP, who could quite likely be based in Westminster from now on. So I think that the clear front runner to be the head of the DUP at Stormont and the First Minister would be Edwin Poots, who is a controversial character. The readers of our morning call email will know that, among other things, he's the current agriculture minister, but among other things, he's quite well known for continuing a ban on gay men giving blood in Northern Ireland beyond when it was ended in England, Scotland and Wales. And that was subject to a high court judgment, which found that that ban was quote unquote irrational. He is notably to Arlene Foster's right on social issues, in case you couldn't tell. And I think unless there's a major upset, it just seems like it's likely to be him. The only caveat to that is that obviously, given the complicated power sharing arrangements in Northern Ireland, the DUP, as the biggest party, can nominate someone to be First Minister, but it does have to be approved by vote by the entire assembly, or, you know, by a majority weighted to the different nationalist unionist splits, which means that Sinn Féin wouldn't necessarily, and you know, including other parties as well, they wouldn't necessarily just vote him in as First Minister with no concessions. So it's a possibility that Sinn Féin would maybe ask for some commitments on either the Irish language or on gay rights or on abortion rights or something. It's very possible that the DUP wouldn't give in to those concessions, which would mean that we would be heading for a Stormont Assembly election, because that's what the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Brandon Lewis, would have to do off the back of that. So that's the path outlined by Edwin Poots, with a caveat that, you know, maybe another candidate could emerge, but that's certainly the consensus so far. And then in Westminster, Geoffrey Donaldson and Gavin Robinson, who are both MPs, seem likely to seek to lead the party overall from Westminster. I think Geoffrey Donaldson would be favoured over Gavin Robinson. And I think that there's also, you know, a potential battle between Edwin Poots and Geoffrey Donaldson there as to whether, you know, potentially Edwin Poots could be both leader of the DUP and First Minister, like Arlene Foster has been. Yeah, those are the main splits. And in terms of whether it would make a difference, I suppose they're all slightly to Arlene Foster's right. She is a relative moderate within her party. So I think that, yeah, there are different personal loyalties behind each of those candidates, but I don't think that in terms of politics, there would be a huge difference between them.
What would be the benefit of splitting, you know, the First Minister role from leader role? I mean, does it come out of Arlene Foster's failings to sort of, or as she's perceived to have failed to to underestimate the risk of Conservative Brexiteers essentially betraying the DUP in the end, and perhaps maybe overplaying their role as power brokers in 2017 with Theresa May's deal? You know, is there a sense that someone who understands or is closer to Westminster could play more of a leadership role while the First Minister focuses more on the government of Northern Ireland, for example?
I think that is very much the feeling. I think it also could maybe be I say this without having any sort of sourcing to suggest it, but I do kind of, I think maybe it could be to manage the different personalities as well, and the internal politics of it. But yeah, I think that it is mainly because there was just a lot of resentment of Arlene Foster leading the DUP from afar among that group of MPs. And I think they don't want that going forward.
Yeah, I think not to sort of ride to the defence of Arlene Foster, but one of the underlying problems that she had as leader was that in order to safeguard Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom, you would have had to be willing to dilute the DUP's commitment to Brexit, which I don't think someone who had, you know, yeah, a former UUP defector, as Alva says, a moderate in the context of the DUP, someone who had, you know, we shouldn't forget that Theresa May's bungling of the 2017 general election didn't just break the back of her premiership, strengthen Jeremy Corbyn's hold over the Labour Party. It also did save Arlene Foster's leadership, because going into that election, she had, as a result, in part of the Cash Flash scandal, which was a very poorly devised renewable. I'm so glad now she's left the scene. I will never again have to try and summarize Cash Flow in podcast form. But yeah, basically a scheme which was designed to encourage people to invest in renewable heating. But because of the way it was designed, even if you didn't just get money for switching existing heating to renewable heating, if you like when I'm going to buy a wood burner and just buy wood for the money, you could get money from it, which she was fairly or unfairly blamed for because she was the departmental minister at the time. I think all of that just meant that the idea should have been able to go, actually, let's have a close alignment to with the EU and sort of deliver that, I think, was never going to be that likely. And because at the time, the parliamentary party here in Westminster was less moderate than the parliamentary party in Stormont, there was also this thing where if she had done that, it's not actually clear that she would have been, if she would have been handing Theresa May a cheque and she couldn't cash. So there are a lot of reasons to split the role, but it doesn't change, like, the underlying problems facing unionism are the Northern Ireland Protocol, the fact that as long as there was a situation where Westminster's pro-choice majority was just kind of blissfully unaware of the fact that none of these votes had any meaningful effect in Northern Ireland, then I think then the DUP would have continued to get what they wanted. But now you will actively have to be persuading MPs down here in Westminster for other political parties who are very committed to reproductive rights, very committed to being, understandably committed to being on both, you know, reproductive rights and being opposed to conversion therapy, to go, yeah, we're happy for that to be devolved in Northern Ireland, which I just don't think is going to happen. You'd have a situation where the Conservative government would have to be willing to get closer to the EU in order to cause the Northern Ireland Protocol not to be a problem. And none of that has ever been in the gift of the leader of the DUP.
Yeah, and I think that that's the striking thing about the two demands that were made of Arlene Foster in the various leaked no confidence letters that were sent to her. The two demands are, as you say, Stephen, to get rid of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which creates that border down the Irish Sea, and then to get rid of the abortion laws. That was mandated last week. I think listeners will remember that more liberalised abortion rights for Northern Ireland were passed by Westminster last year, but it's only within the past few weeks that Westminster has taken steps to force abortion services to be made available in Northern Ireland over and above the heads of the Northern Ireland Assembly, which can't block it anymore. So as you say, it's kind of neither one is super achievable. I'd be really interested to hear from listeners who maybe do see how that circle could be squared, but I don't know which one is more difficult than the other, but it doesn't seem like the Northern Ireland abortion laws or the Northern Ireland Protocol are going to change. I think that the calculation has just been that what has to change is the rhetoric from the DUP about it and from the DUP leader, because Arlene Foster, you know, has been in this kind of bizarre situation of at one point championing the Northern Ireland Protocol and then now having to criticise it, but never really being in a position to improve it very much. And certainly I don't think being very willing to bring the whole thing down, or not as willing as other people in her party. So I think it's more to be seen to be doing something about those issues than to actually secure meaningful change. And as I say, I think it is not impossible that we could be seeing a Stormont election sooner rather than later because of the fallout from this. I think a transition of power between one leader and another in a Northern Irish context always makes Stormont really unstable. And so I think it's hard to see how whoever is elected to replace Arlene Foster could just swoop in seamlessly and be the new First Minister of Northern Ireland. I think without some sort of stalemate for at least a while, even if they resolve it without an election eventually.
And what are the implications of this if there were to be an election? Because something that I thought was really interesting when we were talking about this unrest in Northern Ireland earlier, a few weeks ago, was you were talking about how, you know, Brexit isn't the only reason, and that there was a perfect storm of issues, and one of these was that it was very young sort of children who were involved in the rioting, and that was a sort of symptom, not an excuse, but a symptom of some of the sort of social problems and the dislocation from sort of having a voice and being represented by politicians among those communities, and there is disproportionate poverty in Northern Ireland. And I just wonder, you know, how much are the social issues in the country shifting things as well as fueling dissatisfaction with the leadership, and what kind of bearing could that have on elections, whether they're this year or next year?
I think that it sort of depends on what difference a new leadership makes, because at the moment the DUP is really bleeding votes on either side. So to the right, it's losing votes to the traditional unionist voice, the TUV, who are like really hardline loyalist unionist politicians who would take a similarly socially conservative line to the DUP grassroots. But then on the other side, the DUP are losing support to the moderate, unaligned alliance party mainly, and maybe a little bit to the UUP, but they haven't been performing very well recently. So I think it's you know, if this election was happening without a change of leader, I think you would expect to see the DUP performing very badly because of all those issues that you mentioned, and just this real feeling of like unionist alienation, people feeling left behind, and this mixture of their sort of their unionist identity being left behind and not being respected, but then also the way certain unionist communities are visibly more deprived than nearby Catholic communities, for example. I think that those social issues play into that too. It's less clear, I think, whether all of these problems that unionism is facing, whether they would still be as manifest under a different leader. I think that's the big question. I think there are questions for Sinn Féin too, a little bit, but to a much lesser extent. It's really, I think it would be an election all about how unionism is doing in Northern Ireland, and whether the sort of centrist, more moderate parties can scoop up some of that previous unionist support.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Alva Ray and Stephen Bush. You can find me on Twitter at @Anoush_C.
You can find me on Twitter at @PronounceAlva.
You can find me on Twitter at @StephenKB.
We're produced by Chris Stone, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.